Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
All right, season 4, episode 8 of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Redcon One, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast where we are talking about the 1990 Mr. Olympia contest, which was the only drug-tested Mr. Olympia in the history of the sport. We've had some great guests on so far in season 4. We are finishing off season 4 today with actually a two-part interview with Peter McGough. And Peter is one of the greatest writers in the bodybuilding world. He started his own magazine called Pumping Press out in England. And then that soon caught the attention of Joe Weider. And Joe Weider brought him over to America, to California from England, and had Peter work for him. And then Peter was eventually the editor-in-chief of Flex magazine. So Peter's got a great history in the sport. He also wrote for Muscle Mag International and Muscular Development. And we're going to talk to Peter about his whole career, and specifically about the 1990 Mr. Olympia, which he was a part of, because he was at that show and he wrote a very extensive interview about it. So we got a great interview with Peter McGough, and we talked to Peter for so long, it was about 2 hours, that we decided to make it a two-part interview. So we'll have part one on this week, and then next week we will finish off our season 4 with part 2 of our interview with Peter McGough. All right, I want to mention also we are brought to you by our sponsors, Redcon One. And at Redcon One, everyone wants to be a champion. Everyone wants to be the best. But at Redcon One, they believe in working hard to achieve your goals. Whether you're killing it in the gym or you're running a 6-minute mile, Redcon One has something for those willing to put in the work. They have a premier clinically dosed pre-workout called Total War that is the perfect companion to your workout to give you that extra push to break through your mental and physical barriers. And then after your workout, you can fuel your body with the revolutionary MRE. This is the only whole food complete meal replacement with protein coming from salmon, chicken, beef, and eggs, and the carbs coming from sweet potatoes and oats. And it also contains 10 grams of fat from MCT oil. It is the best tasting complete meal you will ever have. So go to redcon1.com and try the very best that sports nutrition has to offer. Redcon One, the highest state of readiness. And because you are listening to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, you can enter the discount code LEGENDS when you go on redcon1.com, and you'll get 15% discount off your order. And we're also brought to you by Old School Labs. I have been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is a supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements to the discerning athlete. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They are the brand that I've used to win the Masters Natural Mr. Universe in 2012, as well as getting ready for all my photo shoots. It's also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the new 2017 Classic Physique Olympia champion, and Sergio Oliva Jr., who is one of the top pros in the industry, and he is now getting ready for the Arnold Classic. So you can use the discount code LEGENDS12, and you'll receive a 12% discount off your order. Old School Lab supplements that make sense. And be sure to try out their new protein powder called Brawn Protein, which is made from beef, eggs, and milk. So it's just like the old school protein powders. And I have been using it every day, a couple times a day, actually. And it's a great protein powder. So check out Brawn Protein and try that out when you go to oldschoollabs.com. All right, we are getting ready also for the holidays. We're only a couple of weeks away from Christmas. I'll be heading out to Chicago on the weekend of the weekend right before Christmas, because Christmas is on a Monday, I think. So I'll be going to Chicago to visit with my family, and that should be a lot of fun. I hope a lot of you guys are getting ready to enjoy your holidays. And after the holidays, we'll probably launch season number 5 here on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I'm working right now on getting that together, and we're going to be talking about the NABBA Mr. Universe. We're going to take a break from the IFBB competitions, and we're going to talk about the NABBA Mr. Universe, because that has a lot of history in the sport. It started in the 1950s, and some of the real great legends of bodybuilding won the NABBA Universe title, including John Grimmick, Steve Reeves, Bill Pearl, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Frank Zane, Boyer Coe, Chris Dickerson, Serge Nubre. I mean, you name it. All the greats came and went at the NABBA Mr. Universe contest. So I'm working right now to talk to John Citrone, who was competing in the Mr. Universe against Arnold Schwarzenegger in 1968. And John is still in fantastic condition. I just talked to his wife today. Hopefully we'll be able to get an interview with them. We have an interview with Boyer Coe. I'd like to talk to Wayne Galash, who is from Australia, who runs GMV Productions, because he was at many of those NABBA Mr. Universe competitions. Maybe we can talk to Peter again about that. And we're going to try and get as many athletes as we can, some of the old school guys that competed in the NABBA Mr. Universe back in the 70s and 80s and maybe even the 60s, like John Citrone. So I'm working on that. And hopefully, like I said, we can have that ready for you at the beginning of 2018. I want to mention again, my books have been doing really well on Amazon. So thank you to all of you who have purchased the books. A lot of book orders have come from Great Britain and also in Europe. So thank you to everybody who's bought them. The Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends Volume 1 is doing really well. So that's got about 13 chapters in there about some of the old school stories in bodybuilding, especially the Arnold and Sergio confrontations and Frank Zane's Mr. Olympia win and Tony Pearson's Mr. America win, and an article in there about Cal Scalak and retrospective article about Sergio Oliva's life. So it's really a great book. So pick it up. It's a great Christmas present. And if you guys order it on Amazon now, you could probably get it in time for the holidays. Also, my other book, The MP6 Workout, is also doing really well. If you're looking for a new workout routine for the new year, then check this out. It's basically a cycle program, 6-week cycles, one for building power, then the other one for building mass. And it's designed, of course, to get bigger. And the best way to get bigger is to get stronger using the basic compound movements for 6-8 reps. So here you'll learn how to get strength first and then build your strength up, and then you'll be able to build more mass. So that's doing really well also. And I do have some books available if you want an autographed copy. You can just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com, and you can pay by PayPal, and I can send the books out to you right away. I've had a lot of my friends order books for me that way. So if you want to get an autographed copy and not from Amazon, then just email me directly. I got some bad news. Dave Mastorakis, who was one of the old-time bodybuilders from the 1970s, he sent me out an email about a week ago, said Sean Perrine. Sean used to run a website that I used to go on, and it sort of had all the old school guys like me and Peter McGuff used to go on there and talk about the old school days of bodybuilding. And then Sean went on to work for the Weider organization with Muscle and Fitness. And I guess Sean has lung cancer. So he has been going through that. So we wish Sean the best. He's a younger guy than me, and he's always in great shape. He's got like 5% body fat all the time. So I'm not sure how this happened. Life is weird. You never know what's going to happen at what time to anybody. So Sean is really a great guy in the industry. So we wish him all the best. Hopefully he will get through this. I'm not in touch with Sean personally, so I was really sorry to hear that from Dave Mastorakis, but hopefully Sean will be doing better soon. Also, I want to mention my training and diet programs are really doing well. I got a lot of people signing up for December, which was great. Try and get ahead of the new year. I've got a guy, Eric Marino, who's been working with me at the Powerhouse Gym out in Tampa. And Eric has lost 10 pounds in like 2 weeks. He's lost almost an inch off his waist already. So he's doing fantastic. So if you want to get on that program, just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And I will send you out a questionnaire to fill out. And then I will design a personalized training and nutrition program for you, so you can get started on a new program for the new year and start shaping up quickly. Some of these guys are making amazing progress. It's amazing. Once you start on a good diet with the right training and the right cardio, it doesn't have to be extreme. You just have to get on a decent plan designed specifically for you, taking into account your age, your activity level, what your training program's like now, what your nutrition program's like now, and you can really make amazing progress. So it's a very cheap investment for looking better and improving your health. So just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com, and we will get you on that success train so you'll get in great shape before the new year. I did want to mention we got a lot of emails over the last week, people emailing about the podcast. So I want to read some of those. I got one from Paul Cullen, who is from Ireland. He said he is the IFBB's official photographer. And he says, hi, John, I just want to say how much I enjoyed each and every podcast and interview you've covered. In today's era of stereotype world of bodybuilding, it's great to know there's still some down-to-earth golden era true bodybuilding legends like yourself and others from back in the 80s. Keep the old school boat afloat, John. He says, I myself shot international events such as the Arnold Classic Europe, the World Championships, etc. And my favorite memory is capturing the characters still in the sport, such as Dexter Jackson. He says, keep up the amazing work, John, and best wishes and blessings from Ireland. So it's good to hear from Paul. Eric Rudin said, always awesome stuff delivered by you. I love the history you're providing. Renee Jacobson got an email from Renee, and Renee said, simply outstanding these shows, John. Love every minute of it. You should do one where you interview yourself. I would love to hear your story. You look fantastic, and you've done so for many years. Thanks a lot. All right, Renee, thank you. I don't know if I'll interview myself, but maybe I'll get an interview with somebody who can talk about my story one of these days. Michael R. says, John, I'm loving these podcasts. I have them downloaded on my phone for my commute to and from work via your webpage. And he says, now that they're on YouTube as well, I can't help but listen again while I work on my computer at night. These stories are great. You really do a great service for our sport. I can't think of a better guy to document and get these stories in an audio format than you. Thanks again, John. All right. Thank you. And Tony Malzone says, I love listening to the show. I hope you'll be doing shows about other Olympias. Yeah, I hope to do that, Tony. Maybe we can pick some of the 1970 Mr. Olympia competitions that I was at, talk about. So if we can get some guests from that, that would be great. Fab Phil made a comment about the Dorian Yates interview, and he said, holy shit, this is the best Yates interview to date, far superior to the rest out there. And that was it. So we got a lot of emails this week, especially on the YouTube channel, because I've been putting some of the podcasts on the YouTube channel. We've been getting more fans for that. So thank you to all of you who listen to our podcast, and we've got more to come. I also want to mention we're brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services to ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also are comfortable knowing they're there for you every step of the way. They have very competitive pricing also, along with their quality products and services. So those are just a few additional reasons to give them a try. So you can go on their website at flalternativemeds.com or email them at info@flalternativemeds.com. That's info@flalternativemeds.com. Or give them a call at their phone number, 813-922-8939. Again, that's 813-922-8939 for Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, so that is the opening of the show. So here is our interview with Peter McGough about the 1990 Mr. Olympia. This is part one of our interview, and part two will be next week. Enjoy. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and I have a very special guest, my good friend Peter McGough. And Peter, as I'm sure most of you know, was one of the leaders of the magazine scene. He started his own magazine in England, and then Joe Weider discovered his talents and brought him over to America. And then he spent many years working for the Joe Weider organization, and he also worked a little bit for Robert Kennedy. And of course, today we're talking about the 1990 Mr. Olympia. And Peter was at that show, so I wanted to get his thoughts. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. Thanks for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you. How are you doing, Peter? I know you've been going through some health issues a little bit lately, and you know many of us are really concerned about you, and we're always thinking about you. Those in the bodybuilding community, I think we all respect you and appreciate you, and I consider you a good friend of mine. So how are you doing lately?
Well, it was a very rough summer, a couple of crises popped up where it looked quite serious, but I've seemed to have stabilized a bit. You know, I've been dealing with cancer now for over 4 years, so
yeah,
I'm feeling pretty good now. I got a good result a couple of weeks ago. So
good.
And I really do appreciate the support I'm getting from the community, but at the moment, I'm fine.
Oh, great. That's great to hear. Yeah, I think a lot of these younger people, they don't really know what's, you know, anything about the past and everything. So that's why I think it's great that so many people are reaching out to you, and they still know who you are. They respect you, and they know that the value you had in our community, you know, with your writing. And I think it's great that people still look up to you, you know, and respect you. A lot of us older guys, we don't get respected, right, Peter?
You sound like my press agent, John. Thanks for all the praise. I'll leave that up to you. Yeah, I love bodybuilding. I love being in it. I love reporting on it. And in many ways, the 1990 Olympia was maybe the most interesting Olympia I've ever attended because of all the peripheral stuff that was going on.
Yeah, let's get into that in a minute. But tell us a little bit, for those listeners that don't know you, Peter, tell us a little bit about your background. I know you're from England, and you got into bodybuilding at a pretty young age, right?
Yeah, I was 20 when I went into the gym for the first time, okay. 1969, August. I remember it, you know, as soon as I got the pump, I was sold on it, you know, and the gym I worked in, you know, people, they were ramshackle gyms in those days. There was no total fitness and all that business.
Yeah.
I can go back to that first workout, close my eyes and relive it, and I can smell the gym. What you smelt in the gym was sweat and milk, because that was our pre-workout supplement at the time. Got into writing about bodybuilding about 10 years later, started my own magazine with my wife, Anne, which were pumping press. Joe Weider then made us an offer to go to California. We thought we were going for a couple of years. And 25 years later, I'm still in the States. Became editor-in-chief of Flex and Muscle and Fitness hers, and retired from the company in 2009, and I've been doing freelance stuff ever since, just to keep my mind active.
Tell us a little bit about that magazine, Pumping Press, that you did. How was that experience? I know I read stories about Robert Kennedy talking about when he started Muscle Mag International, and of course, Joe Weider, you know, started his magazine way back in the day. So that had to be kind of an exciting but nerve-wracking experience, starting your own magazine.
Yeah, what happened was I'd worked for British magazines, and they did very well in the 80s. But then sort of mid-80s, 85, Flex brought out a UK edition. Muscle Mag did as well. And, of course, the British couldn't compete with 8-page spreads of Bob Paris and all the rest of it. So yeah. I had an idea that, you know, what was missing from the magazines was topical news, gossip, controversy. They tended to be a bit squeaky clean, you know, flex. And we produced a bodybuilding tabloid. Now, what that did, that maximized on the gossip. But the great thing was it almost, I say it preceded the internet, because in those days, you could go to a contest in May, and then you wouldn't read about it in the magazines for a couple of months. You never saw anything. There was no iPhones and emails flying about, you know, showing photographs. But we, with the tabloid, we were able to, say, report the Mr. Olympia, for instance, the 1991 Mr. Olympia, on the Saturday it took place, and the following, 10 days later, it was on the shelves, on the newsagents, and people couldn't believe it. When the 1991 Olympians came to the post-European tour, and we handed out the magazine with the full report, photographs and everything, they just couldn't believe how quickly it was. And it was quite a pugnacious magazine, you know. It was during the time of the WBF, World Bodybuilding Federation,
coming
through. And, you know, eventually caught Joe Weider. Ben Weider actually was the one who approached me first. I knew Ben better than Joe at that point. And here we are.
Yeah, that's great you say that, because, of course, you know, everything's different now with the internet. And you're right. I remember when I would read the magazines as a kid, the first thing I would go to, or the thing that I found most interesting, was the gossip. You know, I wanted to know who was training, you know, for what contest, or who was dating who, or what was going on, you know. So that was the most interesting part of any magazine, whether it was Muscle Mag or Weider's magazine or anybody. I remember you told me a story that one of the guys who really freaked you out was Sergio Oliva, at the 1971 Mr. Universe, the one in London, England, the professional Mr. Universe that Bill Pearl won. So I was wondering if you could relate that story to us.
Well, you know, in those days, we used to go down to the NABBA Universe every year from our gym. We were a busload of us. And it was our, you got to remember, in those days, you only had magazines. There was no videos. You never saw these guys move unless you saw them on stage. Mm-hmm. You know, that you saw the statues move. So I'd been down the previous year, seeing Arnold. He didn't enter in 71. Sergio was in, Bill Pearl was in, and Reg Park. And I'd seen all the photos of Sergio, you know, those massive round muscle bellies, a small bone structure.
Yeah.
But I just wasn't prepared for when he walked out. I just went back in my seat. And I've never really had that reaction since, you know. And it's just like he was second, but to me, he caught my eye, caught my imagination. And, you know, in those days, the competition wasn't like it is now. Dog eat dog, as it were, or whatever. We went down there for a celebration to see our stars. Oh, here's Frank Zane, here's Franco Colombo, here's, you know, Chris Dickerson later on. You saw all these guys, Arnold, saw them move, so it was a once-in-a-year event that we just used to celebrate.
Yeah, I don't think today's generation can understand that, but you're right. I mean, we only saw them in the magazines. We only saw pictures. We never heard them talk. We never saw them move. And to see them in person was like seeing a movie star or a rock star, you know, because it was like, it was so magical for us. I think that's why it was like the magical era.
Yeah, it was absolutely, it was a special time, you know, that we'll never, I could go on about, you know, the pros and cons of the way things are presented now. Some things are better, some things are not so good, but, you know, you're in your 20s, you're living the life. It was a great time, you know. Then we'd all rush back and start to emulate them, get in the gym the next morning, and you know, the place was packed.
Yeah, and the crowds were a lot louder too, right? I mean, I remember going to the Olympia in the late 70s, and the crowds were crazy.
Yeah, they used to go nuts when the guys, because, you know, you never saw them once a year. And the other thing that if you look at photos of that time, especially the 70s, everybody's dressed up to watch. There was none of this ragged T-shirts, and, you know, it was an event. It was an evening out, an afternoon out.
You
would wear a suit and a tie, and it really added to the whole atmosphere.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to see Arnold too then, the year before in 1970.
Yeah. When you know, he beat Reg Park, and I think Dave Draper was third. You know, Dave Draper was in many ways my favorite bodybuilder. He was the one that, when I started reading the magazines in the early 60s, he was the one that caught my imagination.
Yeah, a lot of people love Draper because he was featured a lot in Weider's magazine on the beach.
Yeah, it was the surf boy look, Californian, even though he came from New Jersey. And, in those days, it was like another, you know, nobody from England went to America in those days unless you were a Hollywood film star. There was never any dreams of actually ending up in California. And to think that I did end up talking to Dave and all these guys is just, I've had such a blessed life in that way. At that age, 20, I'd never imagined that I'd have the life and the career I've had.
Yeah. You just mentioned that, I saw on Facebook, you said you think the best writer in bodybuilding is Dave Draper.
Yeah. He writes from the soul. He really gives you everything. And it's difficult to really open your soul and not embarrass yourself. Dave does that. Dave, he's still the same as he was back then. He was never in this for money or fame or glory. And even though he's got books out and got a business, you can still tell he's doing it because he loves what he's doing. He's not doing it to earn an extra book. And he's a very genuine, humble guy. I just love that aspect of him.
Yeah, I got to meet him a few times, and I was impressed by how giving he was and how he seemed like he really cared, even for the short conversations I had with him. So also, let's talk a little bit about your friendship with Dorian Yates, because I know that you were really instrumental in his career in many ways. You got to see Dorian right from the beginning, I think, is the very first show or one of the very first shows you ever did. And a lot of the articles that you wrote about him, I think, sort of told a lot of Americans about this guy from England that many of us didn't know about.
Yeah, I mean, I saw him at the 1985 West Coast Championships in Morecambe, which is a seaside resort in northern England. I'd heard, again, we come back, there was no photos flying around. I'd heard a buzz. There's a kid in England, in Birmingham, you've got to look out for, Dorian Yates. And it's a name that you don't forget. It's not like Fred Smith. Dorian Yates, it sounds like something out of Wuthering Heights or something. So I got to the... We ran into a traffic jam. We got there late, and it was one of those shows where they do straight through. They didn't have an afternoon pre-judging evening finals. Each class came on, did the comparisons, compulsories, straight to the posing, awards given out, next class is on.
Oh, okay.
I missed the comparisons of the novice. I came into the theatre, and across the way I saw Frank Richards, who's just returned from the night of champions, come back after a 14-year layoff and finish fifth. I went to congratulate him. And he was facing the stage, and I was facing him with my back to the stage. And I congratulated him, said, how long are you going to keep going on? He says, oh, probably just another 2 or 3 years. I said, really, why is that? And at that point, I heard, do-do-do-do-do-do-do, the opening riffs of one of the Eurythmic songs. I can't remember the bloody thing now. But Frank said, because of fuckers like that. And I turned around and there was Dorian Yates walking out in that athletic style. He never ambled out with his arms, you know, like his lats were too big and his legs.
Yeah.
He walked out like an athlete. I thought, oh my God, look at this. The British champion... Andrew Searle was there, and he just knew that was it. He was done. You know, he never entered the next year's British Championship. He never entered another contest.
Wow.
And I ran after Dorian and his wife. His girlfriend, Debbie. It was set on the pier, this hall. I ran after him. Said, I want to put you in Muscle & Co., the magazine I was with. He sort of looked at me like I was a nutcase, you know. Then behind me came Ron Davis, the president of the English Federation, saying, I want to invite you to next week World Games to represent England. It was like a Hollywood movie, you know, Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. And, you know, that was a golden moment. And, I mean, you say I was instrumental. I mean, Dorian did it all on his own. You know, an interesting story is... When he made his debut in 1990, the night of the champions, before that I sent an article to Flex with full photographs about Dorian and why he was a star of the future and a possible Mr. Olympia. And I'd done work for Flex for about 10 years. Odd things, maybe every 18 months they asked for something from Europe. So they came on and said, we don't want anything from England. And I said, well, they said, you're only pushing him because you're English. I said, look, since I worked for you, there's been 10 British champions. I've never approached you about those champions. These guys are special. So they never did the article, but Muscle Mag got it. I sent it to Muscle Mag and they did it. Of course, come the 1990 night of the champions, the Weeders were, not Joe and Ben, but the magazine staff were all over Dorian and flying him out to California for photo shoots. So they could have had the scoop. But it didn't happen. And wow. I used to write about Dorian. I mean, his rise, I wasn't the editor-in-chief. His last contest in 1997 was like the month I took over Flex. So I wasn't controlling what went into Flex. You know, I was asked to write certain articles and I'd do them. But, you know, we bonded very quickly. We've got a similar mentality, you know, sort of don't tell people what you're going to do. Just do it and let them make up their own mind, you know. So we've been fast friends ever since, and he's been very, very supportive through this illness. You know, I really appreciate that.
Yeah. So what was it about Dorian? I'm guessing it was obviously more than his physique, although his physique was incredible. There was also something, I'm sure, in his personality and his mindset that made you think that this guy was going to be something else, right?
Yeah, I've never seen such dedication from anybody. You know, he lived like a monk. I mean, I spent a few days now and again at his home. You know, when those famous black and white pictures were taken with the socks I was there for 2 or 3 days. He was like 7 weeks out from the Olympia. He was making his own food. He wasn't one of these guys who had the wife running around doing everything.
Yeah.
He did his own food on the basis that if there's a screw up nutritionally, it'd be all my fault. He never ate in a restaurant at a hotel, never went down there and said, oh, no salt or whatever like the other guys do.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't understand why guys would even, in competition, go into a, you know, an ordinary restaurant and trust the chef to do the right thing. And he was, before he really got into it, he studied bodybuilding in all his aspects. You walk into his house, he's got bookshelves of all sorts of, you know, medical books, not bodybuilding books, physiology. You know, you can almost ask him about any illness and he'll tell you, you know, yeah, everything about it. He studied it. He knows how the human body works. But it was his mental application. He knew that the only way he was going to win was by training and preparing harder than anybody else, that he didn't have the genetics of, say, a Flex Wheeler. You know, that if Flex Wheeler had his drive, Flex would have been Mr. Olympia, but it was Dorian with that drive. And he kept that up right through to 97, when, obviously, with injuries, he was forced to retire in the end.
Wow. He almost reminds me a little bit of Bruce Lee. I was a big Bruce Lee fan before I got into bodybuilding, and I remember they said he had this huge library at home of all these books, like any kind of fighting style, not just karate or martial arts, but boxing, sure, fencing, anything. And he would just study everything so he could learn anything he could that he could apply to, you know, to his craft. And Dorian almost reminds me of that.
Yeah, and Dorian was a fan of Bruce Lee before he got into bodybuilding. In fact,
yeah,
you know a lot of bodybuilders. You know, you ask them, the first, you know, they talk about Bruce Lee all the time. You know,
right,
the first physique star they were attracted to.
Right, right. So how did Joe Weider then approach you, Peter, about starting to work for his magazine?
Well, at the Night of the Champions, 1990, I'd known Ben Weider since 1985. At the World Games that was held in London, and we struck up a rapport. In fact, he asked me to eventually become president of the English Federation, but, you know, I couldn't handle that in the magazine, and I was a magazine guy. I didn't want to get involved in that minutiae of running a federation, but he came to the 1990 Night of the Champions. Joe wasn't there. He approached me, and he said, how would you like to go to California to work for Joe Weider? Now, we'd only done about 9 issues of Pumping Press, but unfortunately, my wife Anne, I mean, we worked, so there was only 2 of us on the magazine. I did all the writing, which was like 30,000 words a month. She sold the advertising, designed it, took care of all the business aspects. We were working silly hours. Unfortunately, she had a miscarriage, and I thought, no, this is, health-wise, this isn't working out. Maybe if that hadn't have happened, I would have said, no, we're going to continue with Pumping Press.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I said, yeah, I'd be interested in hearing what Joe's got to say. So there I was one afternoon in the Pumping Press office, which was above an electrician's shop next to a fish and chip shop in not the most salubrious part of Nottingham, my hometown in England. Mm-hmm. The phone rings. Voice says, Mr. Weider on the phone. Oh, so it comes on. I'd like to come and work in California on Flex Magazine. I love your writing. So I thought for about 1.5 seconds and snapped his hand off. And then we moved out there and, you know, the story unfolded that we... I never went there thinking I was going to be editor or anything. It's just a natural progression. I went there 91 and it was 97 I was made editor. But during that time, I really enjoyed doing the gossip column, Hard Times. You know, like you say, that's what people used to turn to. It was the only source of news they had. You wouldn't see anything on ESPN or the New York Times about bodybuilding, and there was no internet, so the gossip was... even though sometimes it was late, it was red hot at the time because nobody knew.
Yeah. I remember that's what everybody was like. You're right, because nobody knew anything about what was going on in the gyms.
Yeah.
It was like this secret place, you know, so everybody wanted to find out about that. That was the hottest thing.
Yeah.
So you, when you came over here then, was the first Olympia, was that the 90 Mr. Olympia, the one in Chicago?
No, I was still with, that was even before pumping press. With Health and Strength in England then.
Okay.
When I went to the 1990 Olympia. Health and Strength finally, later that year, 1990, went bust because the distributor went bust. And Alex McKenna, you know, who's the publisher, he was very fair about the whole thing. You know, he was a great publisher. And that's what was the platform to sort of say, okay, I'm going to do it on my own now. So we launched Pumping Press. So the 1991 Olympia, I reported for Pumping Press. And then that's when we got the offer to go to America. There was a time when I was doing stuff for Flex and the last issue of Pumping Press at the same time.
Okay. So how many years did you do Pumping Press?
It was only 9 issues.
Because,
you know, one day when you visit me, John, I'll show you the issues and you'll be still amazed at the content that was in there, because I was fighting for our financial lives. I was controversial. I was outrageous. I upset people. You know, I was threatened with all sorts of things. So when I got to America, eventually in the Flex offices, they were expecting this wild man to walk in because they saw me only through the writing. And
right.
I think, you know, I'm pretty, you know, laid back. You know, I'm not shouting from the rooftops or anything.
Right.
They couldn't equate the two personalities. They were looking for, like, I was another Rick Wayne, because he was controversial in his writing, but he was also a larger-than-life character, you know, out of the magazines, in personal interaction. And I built a friendship with Rick that still pertains today.
Oh, great. So let's talk about the 1990 Olympia then, Peter. You said that was one of the most interesting contests you ever saw. And you wrote a 10,000-word article about that. Is that correct?
Yeah, it went in Health and Strength. I mean, normally, you know, a contest report, the Olympia, biggest contest of the year, you know, would be, report would be maybe 3,000 to 4,000 words. I went back to England and said to Alex, you know, this is like so much going on. And he allowed me to do the full article, which ended up as 10,000 words. And of course, it was only seen in England, but it, I had people ringing me, you know, British bodybuilders like Gary Shelmerdine, who was a British champion, and he said, he'd say things like, thanks for screwing up my workout this morning. I walked into the gym, saw the new issue, started to read this article, couldn't put it down, and by that time I'd lost the appetite and the drive of the brain, so thanks a lot.
Yeah.
It really did catch everybody's attention.
Yeah, I got to read that article one of these days.
Well,
so,
you have to visit, John, and you can, you know, I've been asked before to put it online or something. If there was a way to do it easily, I would do, but I'm not sure people want to read 10,000-word articles online these days.
Yeah. Well, like you said, 3,000 is a long article, so that's crazy, 10,000. So what did you find that was so interesting about it? Let's talk about the drug testing, first of all, because this was the first time, the first year they ever did drug testing. They drug tested the Arnold and the Olympia and also some of the big NPC national shows. So there was a lot of people that failed the test. And I think today people may have forgotten about that. But Barry DeMay, who was third in 1988, he failed. And quite a few other guys failed, right?
Yeah, I mean, to sort of set the scene, it was late 1989 when the IFBB announced that drug testing would take place at pro contests.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, everybody was of the opinion that meant all pro contests.
Right.
You know, in the end, it just meant the Arnold and the Olympia. But it was a long-term project because they said in that first year, anybody failing the drug test would lose prize money and the placing, but would not be suspended. But from 1991 on, first failures would be suspended for a year, second failure 2 years, and a third a lifetime ban. So at that point, drug testing seemed a permanent fixture for pro contests. An interesting aside to that is that Dorian Yates was training for the 1990 NIDA champions to see how he did as a pro. He always said if he didn't finish in the top three, he'd retire. Mm-hmm. He wasn't going to waste his time. And he'd already said he wouldn't, if he qualified, he wouldn't do the Olympia that year. But in his early preparation, he was training to pass the drug test, which I think he only found out a couple of months out that there would be no drug test, you know. So it was a bit hazy at that time. And in the end, it was just the Olympia and the Arnold. Of course, at the Arnold, Sean Ray failed. Samir Banu, Nimrod King, Rolf Muller. But they competed in the contest and the results didn't come out till a few days later. So we had Sean Ray having to return his check, and it just was a scandal, really. So they decided at the 1990 Olympia, they'd test the guys before the contest and, you know, have the results on the Friday before the Saturday contest. Those that embarrassment of people having to hand back prize money and trophies wouldn't happen again. They also tested the Miss International that year. The interesting thing there was that Krista Bock and Kim King failed the test, and they did receive a one-year ban, so equality wasn't exactly in style then, you know.
Wow, I forgot about that. I didn't know they tested the Miss International.
Yeah, and you know, going back to the May 9 to the champions, it was very interesting to see the lineup. You know, Dorian was second to Momo Benaziza. Mm-hmm. And there was two levels of bodybuilder. Ones who were, like Dorian and some others, who weren't going to do the Olympia anyway, were on form. Others like Bob Paris, Phil Hill, were way off the best because I think they were trying to clean the system to try and do the Olympia. In fact, the top five at the Night of the Champions who qualified for the Olympia, none of them ended up on the Olympia stage. Momo failed the test anyway. Yates never intended to do it. Interestingly enough, Danny Padilla was third. He didn't do the Olympia, but he did the post-Olympia tour, which was not drug tested. So, you know, you can sort of see a strategy there.
Yeah. So how long was it before the Night of the Champions when the bodybuilders knew that that wasn't going to be tested?
Like I say, I think Dorian only knew about 2 months out. It was after March's Arnold Classic that sort of came out. A lot of it was to do with promoters of pro contests. The smaller ones just couldn't afford the, you know, whatever the finances were involved in getting drug testing sorted out, samples taken, you know, flying guys in early to do a test. You know, they couldn't handle it financially, so it was limited at that point to just the Olympia. So I don't think that became general knowledge till about, well, maybe 8 weeks out from the Night of the Champions. But Dorian never had any problem. When he thought it was a drug testing contest, he was pretty confident that he wouldn't fail. Now, there's a famous gym, or was a famous gym in England, the Forum, full of powerlifting champions. And they'd been, they'd been taking drug tests for years, let's say that, and not failing. So he was friendly with those guys. So, you know, let's be honest, you know, somebody passes a drug test doesn't mean they're drug free. It just means they passed the test.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah, because now we go to the 1990 Olympia, and they did change the testing, so they found out beforehand. So you mentioned the promoters flying them in, so they had to fly these people in early in order to do the test, get the results before they started the contest, so they knew who was clean and who wasn't, or who failed the test and who didn't.
Yeah, that was the idea, that they get the test results on the Friday, so we wouldn't have the embarrassment of trophies handed back and anything like that, and. You know, the press conference, I always remember there was subplots going on around this as well that I should mention now. Lee Haney was going for his seventh Olympia title.
Right.
Arnold's. He just left Weider to go to Twin Labs. And, of course, the conspiracy theories were saying Weider wouldn't allow him to represent Twin Labs and equal Arnold's record. So the drug test was brought into kibosh Haney, which, of course, was a load of hooey. the other thing that was bubbling around was Vince McMahon of the World Wrestling Federation had started his own bodybuilding magazine, Bodybuilding Lifestyles. What was it called? I can't remember now.
I think that's what it was, Bodybuilding Lifestyles.
Yeah. But he denied that he was starting a federation. He was just wanted a magazine. And at the end of it, there was still a suspicion that something there was going on. So there's two subplots around the contest.
You're right. He started the magazine before he started the organization. I forgot about that.
Yeah, the magazine had been out a few months before anything started, federation-wise.
Mm-hmm.
I always remember the press conference on the Thursday. The guys came in, and you could tell straight away, most of them weren't filling the tracksuits with the size we were accustomed to.
Right.
And instead of the journalists there, instead of asking questions, it was almost like a revivalist meeting where a lot of them stood up and said, what a great day this was for bodybuilding. Bodybuilding is now drug-free. See Olympians drug-free. And it really, at that point, I was thinking, just hold on, fellas, hold on. We've just seen them walk in. they're not going to look like they used to. You might change your mind later on.
Right.
And I remember Mike Quinn was pretty vocal, as Mike is, God bless him, is wont to do, saying, look, you guys, and he had a very good point, you're making this all about the drug testing. This is the Olympia. Let's concentrate on the contest and not the drug testing. I'll always remember that. And the other guy that really did fill his tracksuit out was Mike Christian. He was brimming with confidence.
Right.
Speaking openly that he could at last beat Haney, He was one of the few that was at his best. And, of course, we later found out he was using some substance, I think it was called Defense, that helped him get through the test.
Yeah, I just interviewed Mike and I asked him about that. And that, because I interviewed Rich Gaspari, and Rich said the same thing. He said that he found out later that Mike was using this drug called Defend, which was a masking agent for the steroids. So I played Mike that tape of Rich saying that, and he goes, no, I didn't take any of that. He goes, I didn't know anything about that,
Oh, well.
Yeah. So I didn't know about that. They had a press conference, so that's interesting. So you found out a lot of stuff at the press conference. Let's talk about the guys who failed, because there was quite a few of them. There was Barry DeMay, as I mentioned. I think J.J. Marsh, Vinnie Comerford, Momo Benaziza. Who were some of the other names?
I think you got them all. The DeMay, Benaziza, J.J. Marsh, Van Walcott Smith.
Oh, yeah.
Vince Taylor. Friday, I've never known such activity at an Olympia the day before the contest. Everybody was in the hotel lobby waiting to see what was going to happen with these drug tests.
Yeah.
It was the McCormick Hotel in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't normally see the competitors milling around and talking. They're usually lying down in bed or whatever they do.
Mm-hmm.
But the atmosphere was really building. And then about 3:30, we started to hear there had been some drug failures, but no public announcement would be made. Gary Bartlett, who great Canadian photographer and an old friend and still a friend of mine, had the occasion to go to Wayne D'Amelio, the promoter's room, to collect his press passes. Whilst there, he overheard there had been five failures. He came back and told me that it was DeMay, Benaziza, J.J. Marsh. Did I say Vince Taylor?
Now, Vince Taylor, I remember I was at that show, and didn't he, come out in the first round? And I remember when they all lined up, he looked terrible. Yeah. And then after that, he never came back. So I remember talking to Vince.
He did his compulsories, and then that was the end of it.
Yeah.
Actually, Gary said Vince Taylor.
Oh, okay.
Vince Taylor. It was Vince Comerford.
Yeah,
which then led to a strange interview with me and Vince Taylor, me assuming he'd failed, him not knowing what I was talking about. And, you know, he was looking at me like, I said, are you going to do the post-Olympia tour? You know, that's not drug testing. He was looking at me like, what are you talking about? So it was some time, you know, before I found out that it was Vince Comerford.
Now, okay.
They never made any public announcement. The athletes were told at the athletes' meeting that night who had failed. But it was just that sense of elimination when they came on stage that the public at large knew who wasn't in it, because there was no way you could report that over the internet or anything, which didn't exist.
Right.
They all failed on Winstrol, apart from Comerford, who failed on elevated testosterone levels, which, you know, pleased his girlfriend anyway. But he was quite pissed because he said, you know, they could have tested me an hour later and it got a different result. You know, this isn't black and white science. You know, it's just somebody's interpretation.
Yeah.
The most outspoken was Barry DeMay. He was very angry. And he said he'd be lodging an appeal.
Oh, really?
He just couldn't accept the test result. You know, he said, okay, they say I failed on Winstrol, which he hadn't taken for a year, and it should be out of my system.
Right.
He took a test a month previously, and Winstrol didn't show up. Huh. And he was backed up by this by Dr. Jim Wright, the late Dr. Jim Wright, who was a real expert on bodybuilding and the drug culture, who said that, yeah, he shouldn't have shown up after that time.
That's interesting, because when I interviewed Sean Ray recently, he said he failed the Arnold for Winstrol, and he said he stopped taking it in December, but he said it was a water-based drug, so it shouldn't have stuck around till March, you know.
That was the general, you know, opinion on the water-based stuff, you know, that it wasn't that long-lasting.
Right.
In a certain amount of time, it was certainly a year. The thinking was then that it would have been out of your system.
Yeah, I remember Mike Quinn said that he did Decadrobalin at the end of 89, you know, for the Grand Prix Tour and the Olympia. And he said that's why he couldn't do the Arnold, because he knew the Deca was probably still in his system, because that could stand, you know, that could last for 8 to 12 months in your system. So that's why he had to wait till the Olympia.
Yeah, and at the competitors' meeting that night, which is closed to competitors only, I had my sources. The 15 who were left in the contest were told who was out. And here's a thing that never happened at a competitors' meeting before. At the end, they were reminded that anyone joining a rival federation would be suspended, which, as I say, is not usually said at a meeting.
Right. So
they probably got wind that something was afoot with Vince McMahon and the World Bodybuilding Federation, which was going to be launched.
That's interesting.
Interestingly enough, I spoke to one of McMahon's executives on the Friday night. It wasn't Tom Platz, who was head of talent. And he denied that a new federation was on the horizon. And then he gave me his card, which gave his title, and named his company as the World Bodybuilding Federation. So it didn't take a genius to figure out that something was going to happen, you know?
That's funny.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your view of the competitors themselves when they came out. I was at that contest, as I mentioned, and I thought, you know, a couple, like especially Mike Christian, looked better than ever. But most of the guys looked off, like way off, and some of them looked just terrible.
Yeah. To me, and you've got to remember this, John, as you know, reporting contest, I'm not just relying on my memory here of 27 years ago. I've got the report. I've got loads of notes. I wrote these things in real time as I saw it.
Yeah.
And when they came out, the only ones that looked to be near the best to me was Francis Benfatto, Mike Christian, and Frank Hillebrand. I mean, Hillebrand wasn't, you know, a front runner, but he looked as good as he usually did. Everybody else was down or soft, including Haney, you know.
Yeah.
And he was still the biggest guy there. And, you know, Lee Labrada wasn't as tight as he could be, but I thought the contest would be between Christian and Haney. But the thing with Haney, and this, it was lighter, but this is one thing I've always noticed, pointed out about Haney. On his own, he looks great. But when he stands next to somebody, he looks even greater. You know, he just, you know, he's got everything there, and then he stands next to somebody else and shows up all their inadequacies.
Yeah, even that's a great point.
As a smaller Lee Haney, he still had that sort of overpowering size and balance over everybody else. You know, Francis Benfatto, he looked his normal self, and in some ways he was the star of the show. He was animated on stage. He was messing around. He was, during the pose down, they had a funny cantilever stage.
Yeah, I remember that.
Platform that came out of the stage where you could just about fit four or five guys on. So during the pose down, it was really congested with six guys.
Yeah.
And he was getting to the front and barging Pete. And it was like, I thought he was going to do a double somersault into the press pit at one point. It was getting so precarious.
Right.
So he was really, you know, animated.
You think he should have beat Lee Labrada? I know those two had a rivalry going back to when they were both amateurs. But Benfatto really seemed to hit his peak at that 90 Olympia.
Yeah, the thing about Benfatto, I mean, he's got a spectacular physique.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, in pure bodybuilding terms, it's going to outrage a lot of people. There's an imbalance. You know, he's got that short torso.
Mm-hmm.
You know, long legs. There's an imbalance there that, you know, Lee Labrada was obviously, you know, much more balanced.
Yeah.
You know, Benfatto was 6.
Right.
I think he could have been higher. Others that didn't do as well as we expected. Eddie Robinson, beginning of the year, had won the Niagara Falls show. Mm-hmm. Went into the Night of the Champions as the favorite, but finished 7th, but he'd qualified for the Olympia. He finished 10th in this one. So, you know, he faded a bit from what he'd been formerly. I've had this discussion with Sean Ray. He doesn't accept that he was down. I saw him as being his legs there, but he didn't have that upper body volume and thickness that he normally brings. You know, that's the way I saw his physique. Rich, you know, he traded on condition, vascularity, you know, the rib glutes, and he was a tad down. And of course, in many ways, in bodybuilding, you're judged against your former self as well as who you're standing next to, which I don't think should happen, but it happens often, and I think that happened to Rich a little bit.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the way I saw him. But overall, you know, people were just looking and then looking at each other. And I went back to recall the press conference and all this revivalist stuff that was going on about, you know, hallelujah, you know, we're into a new era. And the looking, and you got to remember, you know, two of the biggest stars who were going to be in the show that people wanted to see were Barry DeMay and Momo Benaziza.
Yeah.
And so they paid good money, and 5 of the top guys weren't in the contest even. And the rest of them, for the most part, weren't as good as they'd been. So
yeah,
there was a feeling of anticlimax among the audience of the whole thing, certainly.
Yeah.
There was nobody there, very few people anyway, that would say, wow, that was great. Everybody looked fantastic. Let's keep this going.
Yeah, yeah.
That didn't happen.
So how do you feel like most of the competitors looked? It looked like, to me, like Mike Quinn was way off. You could see he looked like he was drug-free because his legs were gone. Ron Love looked way off compared to what we're used to seeing him.
Yeah.
And then even the top guys, you know, like you said, Haney and Sean Ray, Labrada, Gaspari. They were off their previous best. Yeah. So did it look like some of them were really drug free, or that most of them were just trying to get off in time to beat the test?
Yeah, I mean, Mike Quinn the year before, well, 88, I think that was Mike's best year. It was 58.
Yeah, that's when he got sick.
And in fact, the latest issue of Health and Strength that I had with me had Mike on the cover of a shot that was taken in 88 in Gold's Gym just after the Olympia. He said, man, I don't look like that anymore. He was really downcast. He was quite vocal, Mike, even during the Friday. I heard him talking to Jim Mannion saying, this just isn't right. This isn't, you know, this is not the way. And, you know, I presume he was talking about drug testing. And you know, remember, he tried to sort of dampen down the Olympia being all about drug testing. And I don't think he was trying to guard himself. I think he was just, you know, look, it's still a competition. Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
So he was pretty, you know, Mike, he's not going to, he's always going to speak his mind. He's great.
Right.
Great fodder for us. You know, you can always rely on Mike to tell you what he's thinking.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, some of the guys, like I said, Vince Taylor, he looked really off. I mean, it just seemed like some of them knew how to maybe, you know, negotiate the drugs so they could actually pass the test. And others were just, they just didn't look even near the same without them.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Because you go back to the Night of the Champions, you know, I always think if you're going to bring in drug testing, you can't bring it in, say, 6 months' time, we're going to drug test. Mm-hmm. You've got to say 2 years, we're going to bring it in.
Yeah.
Give the guys time to clean up, find out how they can do other things to look at the best. And you'd still produce, I think, two levels of bodybuilding. If you came in and said, right, drug testing is going to come in say, 2020, mm-hmm. you get some guys who'd be preparing for that, finding the way through and all the rest of it. The early results for next year wouldn't be as good because they'd be cleaning themselves up for the next year. Mm-hmm. And then you'd have other guys who say, as we say in England, bugger it. You know, I'm just going to get loaded for burr and my career ends in 2020. You would have two levels.
Yeah.
And I think bringing the drug testing in at such short notice put those guys in a quandary. You know, they spent all the careers, veterans, never having to think of a drug test. Mm-hmm. And now they had to find out ways to, you know, not fail. And for some of them, that, you know, for most of them, it meant a reduced look.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. I wish they would have did that because that would have prepared everybody. And it was interesting how you said that They had this planned out, like, okay, in 1990, if you fail the test, you lose your placing and you lose the money. But if 91, then you get a 1 year suspension. By 92, you're going to get 2 years. So they said, they were pretty much saying, this is it. This is how we're going to do it. And this is here to stay. And so that's interesting. I didn't know that. I didn't know that the IFBB was planning that long term ahead. It wasn't just like an experiment. They said, they were basically saying, this is the way it's going to be in the future.
That was the way it was going to be in late 1989, but two factors then came into it. One, the way the guys looked, like we weren't presenting the best physiques of all time, as the Olympus always had this progression.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the big thing, as the contest ended, World Wrestling Federation staff were going around passing press releases to everybody, audience, press guys, announcing the launch of the World Bodybuilding Federation, a new federation which was going to dramatically change bodybuilding, enhance it, take it to the mass media. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the IFBB, faced with that sort of onslaught, because eventually 14 guys did sign for them,
yeah.
You know, so they did leave. The drug test was quietly forgotten about. There was never any announcement that I can recall that saying, oh, 1991, we're just going to put it aside now and we won't be drug testing. But, you know, the irony was then that the World Bodybuilding Federation, their demise in 1992 was
because of the drug testing.
Drug allegations. But on the wrestling side, you know, Hulk Hogan and everybody got involved, and they had a special doctor in, can't remember his name now, in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, who was looking after them. And then when they tried the drug testing with Mario Di Pasquale supervising the athletes in 92, of course, they ran into the same soft and smaller look. And, you know, Vince McMahon, who loves bodybuilding, I mean, I did an interview with him 2005, did a training session. We shot him in a training session. You know, he realized that he couldn't carry on with the bodybuilding because of all the drug stuff that was going on. But really, you know, those contests, the WBF contests, were pretty wacky, you know, and didn't capture the bodybuilding audience.
Yeah.
You know, it became more showbiz with guys, you know, Birdie May was like a James Bond character.
Right.
You know, all the rest of it, you know.
They're all characters.
It was, but they came out with that announcement right there and then. And then in January, they had a press conference at the Plaza Hotel in New York and presented all those 14 athletes. You know, Mike Christian, Gary Strider, Barry DeMay were probably the leading lights among them, but there was there was others in, you know, Zuccolotto, David Durth.
Yeah, that's great that you mentioned that, because a lot of people forget about that. As far as the 1990 Olympia, they had the drug testing there, but then the WBF came in on that day, on the same day of that contest, and then they said, basically, didn't they tell the athletes, hey, we're not going to be doing drug testing here. You guys can come in, you know, just looking like whatever you want. And that was a big selling point for them, right?
That was the lure, you know, that was the, that they could carry on at the beginning, the same way they'd done previous to their career. But then when they started to come under, so they had the 1991 WBF championships in Atlantic City, and Strider beat out Mike Christian.
Yeah, I think it was Christian.
And, you know, they looked pretty good, all the guys. But a lot of them were discontented with the way, even though they were paid a lot of money, you know, bodybuilders are individuals. I mean, you've probably had the same thing. You can, you try and round them up and it's impossible. It's like chasing 50 chickens around an open field, you know. They're so committed to what they want to do. You know, that they didn't take well to the regimentation that they were given to by McMahon's people. And, you know, all the wrestlers I've ever dealt with, Triple H and Batista and Brock Lesnar, they were well versed in that. They, you know, they wrestle like 250 nights a year at the peak. I mean, ridiculous, you know, the discipline they bring to it. So there was rumblings about, you know, well, we're not sure about the judging, whether it's fixed, because Gary and Mike were the most popular. That was probably the right result anyway. But there was discontent, you know. But of course, when they had to then, because of the scandal that erupted in the Wrestling Federation later in 91, that even forced McMahon to admit that he'd taken steroids, they tried to dampen it down by introducing their own drug testing in 92, and then it fell apart, and it ended up with Vince calling Joe and Ben and saying, you know, basically, I'm wrapping up the Federation. And he still kept on with his supplement company for a couple of years and advertised it in the Weider magazines. Yeah, but that was the end of the World Bodybuilding Federation.
Yeah, that was an interesting time, that's for sure. So looking at the 1990 lineup, how would you have placed them, Peter? What did you write in your report?
Haney is the winner.
Okay.
The Blader and Mike Christian fighting for second. John Ray next. Ben Fatto, because he was in shape. You know, he was cut and dried. And then after that, it sort of fell away, you know. So that's the way I would have seen it. You know, like I said before, the only three I saw approaching the best was Christian, Benfatto, and Hillebrand, who was seventh.
Right.
Because he was pretty hard, and he didn't have the best structure ever, but he made the best of what he'd got that day.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least they rewarded him, you know, correctly and given him a seventh place.
And, of course, Vince Taylor, he retired after that first round, but he was ill, actually. You know, he didn't look good, but he was physically ill.
Yeah.
And backstage, so he had to pull out.
All right. Thank you for listening for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you to Peter McGuff for joining us. And be sure to tune in next week when we'll have part two of our interview with Peter, where we talk more about the bodybuilding industry. We'll also have an interview with Dan Solomon, where we're going to talk about the new movie Bigger, which is the biopic about the Joe Weider story. And Dan was instrumental in getting that all started. So that will be next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank our sponsors, Redcon One, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We'll see you guys next week.